This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The new arrivals in Dori gave accounts of armed men going door to door to seek out and kill adult males, meaning that many witnessed the deaths of their husbands or fathers.
That was UNHCR spokesman Matthew Saltmarsh on the challenges of caring for about 16,000 people who have arrived in the Niger-Mali border area after fleeing a massacre in Burkina Faso. Details coming up. Also, Nigerian authorities held a mass funeral today for victims of the massacre 2 weeks ago at the Catholic Church. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The UN Refugee Agency says thousands of survivors of a recent massacre in Burkina Faso are in urgent need of humanitarian assistance. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The deadly attack by armed men on June 12th in the town of Setenga sent nearly 16,000 people, mostly women and children, fleeing for their lives. The UN Refugee Agency reports they have arrived in Dori, a town in eastern Burkina Faso on the border with Niger and Mali. It adds more survivors of this brutal attack are expected to arrive in the coming days. UNHCR spokesman Matthew Saltmarsh says the attack by unknown assailants killed at least 79 people. He notes it is the deadliest single incident since more than 130 people were killed in a massacre in a nearby town a year ago. He says it marks a further escalation of violence against civilians in Burkina Faso.
The new arrivals in Dori gave accounts of armed men going door to door to seek out and kill adult males, meaning that many witnessed the deaths of their husbands or fathers. Almost two-thirds of those who fled Setenga are under 18. Many have been sheltered by the host community and by displaced families already residing in Dori.
However, he notes hundreds of others are sleeping rough by the roadside. Finding shelter to accommodate the new arrivals is difficult, as Dori is teeming with people made homeless by escalating violence against civilians. Saltmarsh says Dori currently is home to nearly 76,000 displaced Burkinabe, as well as some 20,000 refugees from Mali. He says regional authorities and humanitarian organizations have begun relocating those without shelter to three existing sites in Dori and are preparing additional plots for future arrivals.
UNHCR and partners are preparing to bolster supplies of emergency shelters and core relief items, including sleeping mats, soap, cooking utensils for more than 1,000 families. UNHCR is also working to identify new arrivals with protection needs, such as children and survivors of sexual and gender-based violence, and to get them access to appropriate care.
The UN Refugee Agency is appealing for international support to meet the acute and growing needs of this bereaved population. It says only 20% of the $110 million appeal it has issued for Burkina Faso has been met. This, it says, is too little to run its life-saving humanitarian operation. Burkina Faso's displacement crisis is one of the world's fastest growing. Latest government figures put the number of internally displaced persons at 1.9 million. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, there has been a new deadly attack by the Allied Democratic Forces, or ADF, militia in Ituri province near the border with Uganda. And the M23 militia has been battling government forces in Rutshuru, several hundred kilometers to the south near the Rwanda border. The ADF and M23 are two of the most powerful rebel groups in the region, where more than 100 militias operate, many of them a legacy of wars in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The ADF is an Islamist movement that originated in Uganda with ties to the Islamic State militants. M23 is mostly made of members of the Tutsi ethnic community that claims to fight for Tutsi rights. Journalist Jafar Al-Katanti is in Goma in the eastern DRC. He spoke with VOA's Kate Pondos and a short time ago about the attacks.
Today, it was around 9 a.m. a soldier from Goma, a FRDC soldier, crossed the border and reached the post of policemen of Rwanda and shot them. When he fired, one of them also fired him, and the guy dead. That the situation was at 9. And some minutes ago, some minutes after, locals of the neighborhood, because the border called Petite Barriere is very close to house in Goma, locals came, and there was many trying to cross the border by force to take the body of that Congolese soldier and also to attack the Rwandan policeman who killed him. But the Congolese police succeeded to stop them and told them to wait till authorities come and discuss about that issue.
In addition to what happened today in Goma, there has been continued fighting all week in the area around Bunagana. M23 captured the town early in the week. What's the situation in Bunagana?
Bunagana is still under control of M23 since Monday. But yesterday, a group of local militia, a group of Mai-Mai, attacked Sengerero and take the control of the city, as M23 was fighting against FRDC near Sengerero, and they let some few number of soldiers in Bunagana. That's why those Mai-Mai succeeded to take the control of the city. By the evening, M23 sent a big reinforcement, and those Mai-Mai had to flee, and till now, Bunagana is under control of M23. But ongoing situation now is that even Sengerero is under control of M23. This morning, the FRDC had to left the city, as the enemy was inside the city. The army decided to do not fight in the city, as people will be the victims.
That was reporter Jafar Akatanti speaking with VOA's Kate Bond Dawson from Goma. As mentioned, tomorrow, Belgium's King Philip arrives in Kinshasa, his first visit to the former Belgian colony since the start of his reign in 2013. Millions of Congolese are estimated to have died between 1885 and 1908 after Belgium's King Leopold II declared the country his personal property. The DRC became independent in 1960. In 2020, King Philip expressed deep regret for the suffering and humiliation inflicted on Congo during 75 years of Belgian rule. Business is slow and government offices have shut down as Uganda shifted immigration services from a Congo crossing to the Chanika outpost on the Rwanda frontier after M23 rebels took over the DRC side of the border. The move aims to ease a backlog that has clogged the border since Monday as fighting drags on in the eastern DRC. Catherine Nabi reports from Kampala.
The business community says the fighting has taken a huge toll on their shops. Trucks with goods destined for the DRC have stalled at the Uganda side of the Bunagana border post since Monday, following renewed clashes between M23 rebels and DRC government forces. Reports from the DRC indicate that the M23 rebels have taken control of the Congo side of the border and no government offices are operating in the area, as they have become homes for the rebels. Shafik Sekandi is the resident district commissioner for Uganda's Chesoro district at the border.
You can see now the yard is full of trucks which are supposed to proceed to Goma, but they cannot go because on the side of Congo there's no customs now, there's no police now, there's no migration, there's no fisheries, there's no forestry. So we don't have any person to deal with on the other side to handle exports.
Sekandi says to clear the traffic, Uganda government has opted to use the Rwanda border post at Chanika, to clear people and goods to proceed to Goma.
We have also decided to evacuate the customs here. All the trailers have now shifted from here to Chanika customs, and the migration has also shifted to Chanika to clear people who want to go to Congo via Rwanda.
Instead of only 89.3 kilometers from Bunagana to Goma, the route for truckers to reach Goma has roughly doubled. Sekandi says security officials have restricted Ugandan businesses at the Bunagana border from operating in the night hours.
By 7, all of them should be in their homes. Even those refugees should not move at night because this was like a situation of war. But I want to thank the UPDF here. They are patrolling, they have deployed, and on our side, there's no big threat.
The Ugandan business community says they are losing money due to continued fighting in DRC and are calling for peace to return in the mineral-rich nation. James Hashaka is the chairperson for the Bunagana Town Council Traders United Association.
The impact is very negative because whatever business you have in Bunagana, you must have Congolese involved. So minus Congolese participation in our business here, that means the business is not there. And when you look at all this population, these are the people who have been selling our goods. When they're all here, that means we are not, can't do business. We have lost billions and billions here. Because I wish them peace, and even here. Because minus their peace, we can't have peace here. So these are neighbors.
Continued fighting in DRC, which flared up in March, has displaced thousands of Congolese nationals, most of whom have entered Uganda. Some have chosen to stay at the Bunagana border post to monitor the situation back home, while others have transferred to refugee reception centers and settlements. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
A general strike in Tunisia involved an estimated 3 million workers yesterday as the powerful labor union UGTT lashed out at rising inflation and demanded guarantees that state-owned companies will not be privatized as the government seeks a $4 billion loan from the International Monetary Fund, IMF. Steve McElarney, Executive Director of Project on Middle East Democracy, who witnessed the strike, detailed the strike's impact on and purpose to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
I think it's a little early to know exactly what the response will be or what the impact of this will be. I would also add that I think there are sort of two purposes of this strike. One is the stated purpose that you mentioned of addressing economic concerns, concerns of Tunisian laborers, including inflation and concerns about privatization in the context of a potential IMF deal. I think the other purpose is sort of the unstated purpose, which was to demonstrate the unity of the UGTT and as a show of political force as well. And there had been a lot of speculation that the members of the labor union might not be as unified politically as in the past. And the UGTT has been very critical of President Kais Saied in recent weeks. And so ahead of next month's referendum on a new constitution, I think today's strike is important in terms of sending a signal of strength from the UGTT, which could be a counterbalance to Kais Saied, both politically in general, and then also in terms of some of his policy decisions. So I think there will be an impact of this. It wouldn't be surprising to see them call another strike between now and the 25th of July. I think that could be a possibility, building on the success of this strike. But I think it's clear that today's strike has helped empower the UGTT and shown that it's a force that will have to be taken into account by President Kais Saied in the period ahead.
Tunisian President Kais Saied named a law professor to head an advisory committee to draft a new constitution for a new republic, excluding political parties from restructuring the political system, and he will replace the democratic 2014 constitution with a new constitution via a referendum on July 25 and have a new parliamentary elections in December. The new constitution was set to replace the parliamentary political system with a presidential one to boost president's powers vis-a-vis the parliament. What's your take on that?
I think that the process that you described has been very disappointing in terms of Tunisia retaining its democratic nature and the important progress it made toward democracy over the past decade. As you noted, President Kais Saied is moving forward on a new constitution really without the input of other political actors in Tunisia. He's excluded political parties. He has not engaged constructively with civil society, including with the labor unions that we were just referring to. This is basically being a constitution that appears that it's being written by a small team hand-selected by President Kais Saied and overseen by the president himself. And he may also make changes to the draft that is submitted to him by this small committee. There's a very stark contrast between this process and the open, inclusive process, very democratic process that produced Tunisia's 2014 constitution. And I think that's very troubling. And it shows that Kais Saied's instincts are not democratic. And his behavior has been more like that of a strongman dictator since expanding his power in last July. So I think all of these signs are very troubling.
Tunisia's Islamist-inspired Ennahda party warned against dropping references to Islam in the new constitution set to go to referendum next month. Was a constitution draft stripped of any reference to religion designed to further weaken the influence of the Islamic parties?
To be honest, personally, I think that this was largely done as a sort of distraction. I don't think that it's important to President Kais Saied that there not be language about Islam in the constitution. I think that he and his advisors and those who he has asked to draft the constitution know that these kinds of issues, such as language about the identity of Tunisia and as an Islamic state, Islamic Republic, would captivate the public's attention and perhaps distract from other very important substantive issues, including the structure of government and the balance of powers and such. And I expect that language will remain in the constitution, noting that Tunisia is an Islamic country. But I think by suggesting the possibility that it would not, I think that he has diverted public attention from other issues that may be more important to him in this constitution.
That was Steve McLean-Ernie, Executive Director of Project on Middle East Democracy, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Nigerian authorities in southwest Ondo State held a mass funeral today for victims of the massacre 2 weeks ago at a Catholic church. Authorities blamed the Islamic State West African province for the attack, which killed at least 40 worshippers and raised fears that the terrorist group is spreading from the north to other parts of Nigeria. Timothy Obiezu reports from Owo, Nigeria.
Owo resident Onyekachi Ozulumba woke up early Friday morning, dressed up quickly, and went to his elder brother's house in the southwestern Nigerian town. From there, they went to the mortuary to escort their mother's remains to the venue of a mass burial ceremony organized by the Ondo State Catholic Diocese and state authorities. Their mother, 85, was there at St. Francis Catholic Church on June 5th when armed men opened fire and detonated explosives, killing at least 40 worshippers. Ozulumba says his mother was hit by an explosive which blasted open her stomach. He says the bomb scattered her body to the point that we could not even pick her up. We collected pieces of her body on a flat piece of wood, he says. Without that wood, we wouldn't have been able to lift her, he says. We're in deep sorrow. At the venue, hundreds of people gathered to witness the funeral mass, including state and church officials. As the bodies of the victims arrived at the venue, an already tense hall was filled with voices crying from various corners. During the mass, church authorities denounced the attack and said the government must do more to protect citizens. Catholic Bishop Emmanuel Badijo was one of the officiating clergymen.
I call on President Buhari and our leaders in the federal government and state government to wake up, sit up, and act up to secure life and property all over Nigeria. How many more must die? Does life really have any value anymore with you?
Ondo State Governor Rotimi Akeredolu responded to the criticism and promised to improve security.
What has happened to us in Owo is indescribable. And we still have over 70 in the hospital. Some have been discharged. I am here before you to accept a failure on security. We have failed. We have failed. We have failed to defend these people.
Nigeria is seeing an increase in attacks by armed gangs as the country's general elections draw closer. Outgoing President Buhari promised to improve security when he was voted in 7 years ago. The Nigerian parliament is calling for a state of emergency in Ondo State. Also, an armed security unit in southwest Nigeria known as Amotekun, supported by regional authorities, has vowed to keep people safe and go after perpetrators of the church shooting. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Owo, Nigeria.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For the first time in 20 years, progress toward ending child labor has taken a step backward. Child labor globally is rising, not falling. Between 2016 and 2020, the number of children in child labor globally increased from 152 million to 160 million, said Thea Lee, Deputy Undersecretary of Labor for International Affairs.
Those figures are through the beginning of 2020. And we know that COVID has actually made this problem much worse, that it has thrown families into poverty, it has disrupted economies and supply chains, and that has put many more children at an even heightened risk.
Of the 160 million, more than 72 million children live in sub-Saharan Africa, according to the International Labor Organization. Many of them are denied an education and toil in hazardous working conditions as child soldiers, cobalt miners, and cocoa workers. Some are treated as little more than slaves. Others are lured by fraud into dangerous and degrading work. Speaking in mid-May at the 5th Global Conference to Eliminate Child Labor, Deputy Undersecretary Lee said that this is a moment of crisis. We know that children workers and adult workers in forced labor are often in the shadows.
Many are out of reach of regulation. They work in homes, in mines, or in fields that labor inspectors rarely visit. And at the bottom end of global supply chains, far out of sight of the consumers who ultimately purchase their products.
For its part, the U.S. government is using a mix of approaches to the problem, said Undersecretary Lee. We use our research and reporting, but we also use trade enforcement and monitoring. We use technical assistance projects, and we use multilateral engagement and labor diplomacy to address these issues. Being able to track what happens and where goods go through the global supply chain is a critical tool in the fight to end labor exploitation.
We're looking at critical supply chains, like cocoa from West Africa, cobalt from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, polysilicon from China, which is a key input into solar panels, and many others.
Child labor is a form of child abuse, said Undersecretary Lee. It is the job of governments to make sure that nobody is profiting from exploitation of children, because this is a heinous crime.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Justin Thwaite, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and